Okay, so let's get started with our last talk on cell cycle regulation. And let me first acknowledge the financial support we've gotten over the years from DARPA and recently from NIH and from the James S. McDonnell Foundation. It's been greatly appreciated. Standard introduction to the cell cycle. It's the sequence of events by which a growing cell replicates all of its components and divides them more or less evenly between two daughter cells so that the daughters inherit the information and machinery necessary to repeat the process. So the cell cycle is the basic underlying process by which cells replicate themselves. It underlies all of biological growth and reproduction. The most important molecules that need to be replicated and partitioned to the daughter cells are, of course, the chromosomes, the DNA molecules. And in eukaryotic cells, the processes of chromosome replication and the segregation of the daughter chromosomes are separated in time. So as you know, the DNA is synthesized during the S phase of the cycle, and then the replicated chromosomes are segregated to the two daughter cells during mitosis. And S phase and M phase are separated by two gaps, G1 and G2. Now, there are three defining characteristics of the cell cycle that I want to emphasize up front. So just like circadian rhythms has defining characteristics, that it's an autonomous oscillation, close to 24 hours, ability to phase shift, and temperature compensated. Those are the fundamental characteristics of the circadian clock. The cell cycle rhythm also has some essential defining characteristics, and it's these three. It's essential, or nearly essential, that cells alternate S phase and M phase, alternately replicate the DNA and then segregate the DNA to the daughter cells, so that from generation to generation, cells have the same number of chromosomes. Of course, this is biology. There are exceptions to every rule. There's meiotic divisions in which you have a division without an intervening DNA synthesis. And there are some tissues that become polyploid, so you have many replications of DNA without a division. But in the long run, as a general rule, you have to alternate S phase and M phase. Secondly, it's crucial that the cell balance the DNA replication and division cycle with the overall growth. So this is called balanced growth and division. So there are two different cycles that you have to think of. The DNA division cycle, replicating the DNA and then dividing the cell in half, has to be balanced with the overall growth of the cell, the mass doubling of the cell. And the mass doubling kind of occurs independently of the DNA division cycle. But in the long run, the two processes have to be balanced. In other words, the cell cycle time, the time between successive divisions, must be the same as the mass doubling time. Because if the cell cycle time is shorter than the mass doubling time, cells will get smaller and smaller and smaller and die. And if the cell cycle time is longer than the mass doubling time, they'll get bigger and bigger and bigger and they'll die. So in the long run, they have to be balanced. There are, of course, exceptions to that rule. The embryo is an exception because the embryo is a huge egg and its job is to divide smaller and smaller and smaller, to make small cells. And then eventually that process stops and the normal cell cycle takes over. The third defining characteristic of cell cycle regulation are checkpoints. So when something goes wrong with the process, like you're not able to finish DNA replication, or the chromosomes aren't properly aligned on the mitotic spindle, then a signal is generated which blocks progression through the cell cycle until the problem can be fixed, and then the checkpoint is lifted and one can continue. Okay? Now, we've already heard quite a bit about the underlying molecular machinery, and we've heard about, Attila talked yesterday about how cells are able to alternate S phase and M phase because they have these two promoting factors, S phase promoting factor and M phase promoting factor, that go up and down, and then they have these specialized switches that sense the going up and coming down of SPF and MPF and trigger first DNA replication and then mitosis or exit from mitosis. And we heard from Jill about Jill and Andrea about checkpoint controls for unreplicated DNA and alignment on the mitotic spindle. What I want to emphasize is the balance of growth and division. So that's the feature of the cell cycle that I'll be talking about especially. Okay, now as you also know, the major events of the cell cycle are governed by these heterodimers, a cyclin-dependent kinase and its partner, a cyclin. And the cyclin-dependent kinase, phosphorylates target proteins and activates those proteins and triggers the various events of the cell cycle. So to understand the timing of events and the coordination of events, we have to understand the control system for the cyclin-dependent kinases. There are three or four major classes of cyclins that control the activities of these kinases. The early cyclins involved in events in G1 and the G1 to S transition. Cyclin A involved in DNA synthesis and going into mitosis, and cyclin B absolutely essential for cells to go into mitosis and complete the mitotic process. And the final cyclin B dependent kinases inhibit the last step of the mitotic cycle. So if you hold their activities high, cells will be blocked in metaphase, and in order to complete the cycle, you have to remove the activity of the cyclin dependent kinases, and you can go exit from mitosis and go back into G1. And that exit from mitosis, as we've heard already, is facilitated by this complex of CDC20 and the APC. When it's activated, it dissolves the glue that's holding the sister chromatids together so that they can be separated at anaphase, and it also destroys the cyclin partners of the CDK, removes that activity, and the cell can go into G1. But then CDC20 activity disappears, and it's replaced by a homolog, CDH1, and CDH1 is active throughout the G1 phase and keeps the cyclin keeps the cyclins low because it degrades any cyclins that might be synthesized. And there's also a cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor that's very prevalent in G1 phase of the cell cycle, so any dimers that might form are quickly bound up by the inhibitor as inactive trimers. And these enemies of the cyclin-dependent kinases have to be destroyed for the cell to leave G1 and go back into the cycle SG2 and M. Okay, so those are the basic players, and this is a wiring diagram for more or less a full model of these events in the eukaryotic cell cycle control system. So here are the promised cyclins, the major cyclins, cyclin B, cyclin A, and cyclin E, and their kinase partners. And here's CDC20 degrading cyclin B, and cells come out of mitosis. CDH1 also degrading the cyclins. The CKIs forming these inactive trimers. And we heard a lot yesterday and Tuesday about this part of the control system where the cyclin-dependent kinase can be phosphorylated and inactivated by WEE1 and activated by CDC25. So you need a model of this sort of complexity in order to be able to explain the basic features of progression through G1, S, G2, and M in eukaryotic cells. And this also seems to be quite a generic model of all eukaryotes that have been studied in any detail. They all have these components, and they're always wired together more or less in the same way in all eukaryotes as far as we can see. Although eukaryotic cell cycles, the physiology of the cell cycles can be quite different in different circumstances. It seems to be governed by the same underlying control mechanism. Now, we've already seen in Jill's talk and Joe's talk that this part of the control mechanism is a bistable switch because of the positive feedback in the system. And this part of the control system is a time-delayed negative feedback. Cyclin B activates the APC and CDC20, which destroys the cyclin B activity. So that's a negative feedback loop, and it can generate oscillations or damped oscillations. We haven't talked too much about this part of the control system. The G1 phase of the cell cycle is stabilized by active CDH1 and by the cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor. And this part of the control mechanism is also a bistable switch because of dual negative feedback. CDH1 is trying to destroy the activity of the cyclin-dependent kinase, but if you can get enough active cyclin-dependent kinase, it'll phosphorylate CDH1 and inactivate CDH1 and stabilize the cyclin. So those are molecular enemies of each other, molecular antagonists. And also, the CKI is trying to wrap its ugly arms around the cyclin B dimer and inhibit it, but if some of the kinase can get free, it'll phosphorylate the kinase inhibitor, and when the kinase inhibitor gets phosphorylated, it's rapidly degraded. So those two components are also molecular antagonists, and that part of the control system also creates a bistable system that stabilizes the G1 steady state, but then eventually that can be released and the cell can go into SG2 and M. Any questions? This is the introduction.
Can you say something about nomenclature? My impression is that CDC25 in one system has a different name in another system. Are all these names the same for all eukaryotes?
No, they're all different for all eukaryotes, and that's a big mess, okay?
Okay, so the names you're giving us are for what organisms?
These are kind of generic names. They're kind of mammalian-ish names. Okay, I'm going to change all the names in the next slide because we're going to specialize on budding yeast. Okay, so first part of my talk, I want to describe models, realistic models of the budding yeast cell cycle, and give credit to the people who did most of the work at Virginia Tech, Kathy Chen, Laurence Calzone, and George Soren Batoktok. At the Technical University of Budapest, Bela Novak, Attila Csikasznadzs, Andrea at IFOM, and Fred Cross is our experimental collaborator at the Rockefeller University. And I have to say especially that all the heavy lifting in this problem was done by Kathy Chen.
She's topless.
Yes, but she's discreetly turning her back to you. Okay, for budding yeast, all the names have changed. So these are budding yeast names. The cyclin B is CLIB2. The cyclin A is CLIB5, that drives DNA synthesis. The cyclin E, the G1 cyclin, is called CLIN2. The inhibitor is called CYK1. What else? This part of the control mechanism is more or less missing. The pieces are there, but they're used for a different purpose. They're not used to get through the normal cell cycle, so we can get rid of that part of the control system altogether. What else? The cell cycle control system has to be coupled to cell size some way, and there's good evidence in yeast that cells read cell size by controlling the amount and the activity, the functionality of a kind of size-sensing cyclin. And in budding yeast, that's a special cyclin called CLIN3. It's exquisitely sensitive to cell size. When cells get big enough and get enough CLIN3 activity, then CLIN3 kind of kicks off the whole process because CLIN3 can phosphorylate and activate the transcription factor for these early cyclins that are necessary for the budding event and for DNA synthesis.
Hmm?
CLIN3 is present more or less at constant level during the cell cycle. There's a slight oscillation, not very large. It's not very abundant, CLIN. It's pretty rare, but it's very active. And it has a nuclear localization signal. It goes into the nucleus, gets concentrated in the nucleus. And our idea is that when cells are too small, they just don't have enough CLIN3, that even if all of it's in the nucleus, it can't get its job done. When the cell gets a little bigger, finally gets enough CLIN3 accumulated in the nucleus where it does its job. And it's a bifurcation parameter in your system, in our system. You'll see it in just a second.
Constant with respect to size?
No. I mean constant with respect to total mass of the cell. So as the cell grows, the relative amount of CLIN3, its concentration in the cell doesn't change very much. The other cyclins undergo huge variations. Okay?
But the nucleus doesn't change much.
But then, yeah, or the place of action inside the nucleus doesn't change much in its effective volume. So what we're thinking is that the CLIN3s get synthesized in the cytoplasm, they come into the nucleus, they get concentrated at their site of action, and eventually get enough of them to trigger these events. Okay? Good question. Okay. So we take that wiring diagram and convert it into differential equations by the usual techniques. We get a lot of differential equations, 30, 40 differential equations. And of course, lots of parameters. There are kinetic parameters that we need to describe all the reactions in the network. So there are probably 100 or more parameters in this model. And the challenge here is to see whether this wiring diagram is consistent with all the information we know about cell cycle regulation in budding yeast. Okay? So suppose we have a set of rate constants and we can do a simulation, the rate constants for a wild type fission yeast cell, then this is what our simulations would look like. We have a variable that represents mass, which is increasing exponentially during the cell cycle, and then the cells divide and the mass gets reset. For budding yeast, the division is asymmetric. So mass gets reset by a factor of less than a half. If we're following the daughter cells, they're smaller than mother cells. So mass gets reset to a low value, and the daughter cells have a long cycle time. If you want to follow the mother cell, the mass gets reset to some size here, and you get shorter cell cycles. Mostly we'll follow daughter cells. And what you notice that is initially a newborn daughter cell is in the G1 phase of the cell cycle. It's full of the inhibitor SYK1 and CDH1, the degradation system, is at full activity during the G1 phase of the cell cycle. When the cell gets large enough and gets enough activity of CLIN3, then CLIN3 turns on the transcription factor for CLIN2. The CLIN2 cyclin rises, binds with its kinase partner, phosphorylates SYK1, and so SYK1 is destroyed, degraded, and phosphorylates and turns off CDH1. And then the B-type cyclins can come up, CLIB5, which isn't shown, and CLIB2, which together drive the cell through S phase and M phase up to mitosis. And then the CDC20 is activated at the end of the cell cycle. The B-type cyclins are destroyed, and the cell goes back to G1. Question in the back.
Thank you, John. Is there any reason to make a distinction between the levels of the protein and the activity in these particular models?
In these models, because we don't have the tyrosine phosphorylation and dephosphorylation part of the system going, the activity of the cyclin-dependent kinases is just driven by the amount of their cyclin partners. Okay. David?
Does nuclear localization not play any role? Translocation,
I mean. Yeah, it does, right? Because I just explained that these cyclins go into the nucleus and get concentrated in the nucleus. So we're cheating a little bit here, and we're just writing differential equations for, let's say, their activities, their effective activities of the different components, and not bothering to keep track of whether that effective activity is in the cytoplasm or in the nucleus. Okay?
But what you're saying is the delays in getting into the nucleus are...
They're short. They got to be short compared to the time scale here, which is hours, hour and a half, 2 hours.
Whereas in the circadian models, translocation to the nucleus is actually... an important delay.
Yeah, I don't think it's an important delay here. You could put it in. You got more variables and you got more undetermined parameters. And another way of looking at it is maybe we can tuck those parameters into other phenomenological rate constants that are in the model. So I'm going to get to the rate constant problem in just a second. So this is, if we did have rate constants, we could do a simulation like this. We could see how all the components are changing in time, and we can correlate the comings and goings of these different components with observable events in the cell cycle, like the initiation of a bud, which you can see, the initiation of DNA replication. Initiation of the bud is driven by CLIN2, DNA synthesis by CLIB5, which I haven't shown, and mitosis by CLIB2. And then exit from mitosis when these things are destroyed at the end. Okay, now what the model needs to explain is not only the properties of the wild type cell cycle in budding yeast, but the curious properties of all the mutants that you can construct by knocking out and overexpressing the genes that encode the proteins in the control system. And not only single mutants, but double mutants and triple mutants and quadruple mutants and any combination that the molecular geneticists may have studied in some detail. So we make a big table of all the mutants that we can find in the literature. So the genotype of the mutant is in the first column, and the phenotype of the mutant is in the last column with a reference to the literature. So a one-time Gal CLIB2 overexpressor without a degradation box causes telophase arrest. Okay, this is a description of the experiment that's done and of the observed phenotype of these mutants. Some of these mutants are inviable. They're arrested at a certain phase in the cell cycle. Other mutants are viable. They can grow and divide. They can replicate themselves. But they always have some curious difference to wild-type cells. The G1 phase may be longer. There may be a gap between budding and the initiation of DNA synthesis. They may be a different size from wild-type cells. So we just make in this table, we collect all that information that we have about all these mutants. And then the challenge is to see if we can simulate the properties of these mutants by making changes in the rate constants that are consistent with the genotype of the mutant. So in this case, a SIC1 deletion mutant, you get rid of that that inhibitor, so you have to find the rate constants that describe the synthesis of the inhibitor and set those rate constants to zero, so you don't make any inhibitor. That's the only change you're allowed to make, and then you have to simulate the properties of the cell cycle and compare to the observed properties of the mutant. Okay? So I think of it this way. We have a big set of differential equations that are determined by the wiring diagram. The wiring diagram is our hypothesis of how the control system is put together. And the differential equations are just a computer-readable form of that hypothesis. Then in another box, we have all the rate constants, which at the start are unknown, they're empty. And the challenge is to fill in all those boxes, and can you find a set of rate constants which, when combined with the differential equations, will generate agreement to the phenotypes of like 130 different mutants? Okay? So that's not a trivial problem, although many people, I think, try to trivialize it. But if you have a big model with lots of parameters, you ought to be able to fit anything. You ought to be able to fit an elephant, and we're only trying to fit a yeast cell, which is much smaller. You know, but that's crazy. Because if your model's shaped like an artichoke, you can't get it to fit an elephant, no matter how you twiddle the parameters. So the question here is whether the model, the wiring diagram, is shaped like a yeast cell. And the only way to tell that is if you can draw out a yeast cell with all of its properties. Yeah?
But here it seems to me you're arguing something a little different. You say you have on the order of 100 different parameters to fit, and about 100 different data points, 100 degrees of freedom.
We have 130 mutants,
yep.
But every mutant gives us at the least one bit, viable or inviable, but of course more than that, because the inviable mutants have to arrest at a proper stage in the cell cycle. You can observe the stage in the cell cycle where they're arrested, so you know who's up and who's down. And the model has to agree with that. And the viable cells, they're viable, but they're always different from wild-type cells. They're 50% bigger. The G1 phase is extended by 10 minutes. Things like that, right? The model has to get all that stuff right.
No, but I think this, to me, is a little different than the usual argument that complex models can fit an elephant. Because usually people are trying to fit many fewer bits.
Yeah.
A very complex model is
trying
to fit a lot of bits.
We're trying to fit a lot of information.
Another important fact is the map from parameters to solutions of differential equations is effectively taking a high-dimensional space into a low-dimensional space.
Is that the same thing as that?
No. You may have 100 parameters, but you can't move the solutions in 100 independent directions.
Yeah, I think that's true, right? And what the wiring diagram is trying to tell you are what are all the interconnections among the pieces.
Yeah.
So if you twiddle one parameter, like the synthesis of SIC1, you can guess what the immediate consequence is going to be of not having the inhibitor. But how do those consequences fan out through the whole mechanism? And what are their secondary and tertiary implications? And that has to fit the observed phenotypes of the mutants. Jeremy?
Yeah.
I guess the point, though, coming back to what David just said, is that it's not so much whether or not you can fit the elephant, but the fact that you can fit the elephant in many different ways, precisely because there is that collapse from parameter space down onto function. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the issues with fitting broadly is going back, you know, people fit all the time, and so crystallographers fit mm-hmm. X-ray data. Mm-hmm. And what they have is a way of measuring the extent to which their fits are better than they were before. Mm-hmm. And they usually do this by partitioning, you know, training data and test data, and having statistical measures that will actually say the extent to which they are fitting better by particular choices of parameters as opposed to others. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, in taking this kind of thing forward, it's not just an issue of saying, can we get an explanation of this particular phenomena, but whether, how many different explanations of that particular phenomena are there? Because if there's one, there's likely to be many.
I don't know. I do know there are lots that don't work. There are lots of wiring diagrams that we could never parameterize to fit the data, and we had to readjust the wiring diagram. What I can tell you is that wiring diagram that I showed you with the parameter values that we can display are consistent with almost everything that's known in that data set, but not completely consistent. Of the 130 mutants, there were 5 or 10 that didn't agree. I say 5 because there were 5 that we got completely wrong, and Kathy says 10 because there are another 5 that she doesn't like the way they fit, but she has higher standards than I do. You can twiddle the parameters. At that point, we can twiddle the parameters to make any one of those mutants that doesn't fit. We can fit those mutants by twiddling parameters, but then we break 2 or 3 others for every one we fix. So ultimately, we had to decide to sweep all the errors into a few mutants as possible, and also into the mutants that we were the least confident in. So the model doesn't fit everything. There are a couple of reasons for this. It could be that not all observations are correct. It could be that the wiring diagram isn't right. It could be that we're not quite in the right region of parameter space.
Mm-hmm. Is there other large class of parameter sets that accomplish very similar things?
There are not, as far as we can tell. So Kathy did all the fitting by hand. So we have the Kathy Chen approved parameter set. And then we tried to talk the computer into beating Kathy by a global search through parameter space and a very complicated cost function to kind of penalize for not getting mutant phenotypes right. And the supercomputer chugged away over the weekend and came back with a couple of sets that seemed to be better than Kathy, which really galled her. So she had looked at those more closely, and she found, of course, the computer comes back giving you parameter values to 9 or 10 significant figures. And Kathy just took all those parameter values and rounded them off to 2 or 3 significant figures and recomputed, and then found that the fit wasn't any better than hers. Meaning what the computer was doing was cheating like crazy and finding little places in parameter space where it could adjust things just right to satisfy some requirement on one mutant and on another mutant. It was all phony. There was no robust solution of these problems that's better than Kathy's or even as good that we can find by this. But it's a big parameter space, a little hard to say convincingly, but we have tried to study these things. I don't want to go talk any more about parameters, okay? That's more than I usually say.
Some of these rate constants, are they known experimentally in your model?
You can measure effective half-lives of cyclins at different phases of the cell cycle. But all the phosphorylation and dephosphorylation reactions and things like that, they're not known very well. We have to guess them. Yeah, you go.
The observations that you mentioned are called discrete. I mean,
yeah.
But presumably one can actually follow the concentration of various proteins in the cell.
We'd like to, but we don't have that kind of data. People don't measure the activities of these proteins as functions of time during the cell cycle, except in some very unique circumstances. Mostly what you do is you make a mutant and you characterize its phenotype. You look at it under the microscope. We're trying to guess what the underlying molecular biology is from those very qualitative observations, and it's something of a miracle that we can make it work. Of course, the quantitative model makes a gazillion predictions, quantitative predictions about what's going on inside these cells. Whether anybody's going to ever try to confirm those predictions or not, I don't know. We can also make qualitative predictions because there are some mutants that have never been put together before. And as long as they're mutant combinations of the genes that are in our model should predict the phenotypes of those mutant combinations. Now, some of them are kind of trivial, and anybody could predict them, but there are other combinations which are less obvious, but the model's never really been put up to a fair test of a new interesting mutant that hasn't been characterized yet, and then tested against what the best molecular geneticist in the field would predict.
But if you sound like, that's actually one of the reasons why I'm asked about translocations in the nucleus and that. Because I don't know whether maybe when you GFP tag these proteins, everything goes wrong, but I mean, that would be give you a lot of data that would. You, in some sense, should inform the model quite strongly.
So the only experiment I know along those lines is Fred Cross was looking at CLIN3 and at the movement of CLIN3 in and out of the nucleus. And he manipulated the nuclear localization signal and the nuclear export signal on CLIN3 so he could adjust how it's partitioned between the two compartments. And he got results that are qualitatively consistent with the model and quantitatively consistent. It looked good enough to me, although Fred complains about some features. But, you know, if you push more CLIN3 into the nucleus, cells divide smaller. And if you keep it in the cytoplasm so it can't get into the nucleus, cells have to get much bigger before they think they're big enough to divide because we don't have enough CLIN3 in the nucleus. You can do those kind of experiments. Some of them have been done. Okay? I'd like to move on, if I may. If you're interested in following up on this particular model, this very realistic model of the budding yeast, we have a web page where all the mutants are displayed. The parameter values are all there. You can simulate any mutant you want to. You can compare the simulations to the observed phenotype. So here's just one example of a quadruple mutant. You knock out all the CLINs and SYK1 happens to be a viable cell. You can see the oscillation. So all the 130 mutants are on the web page. Okay. So I want to describe the one parameter bifurcation diagrams computed from this model and show how they explain this phenomena of balanced growth and division. So recall what a one-parameter bifurcation diagram looks like. We're plotting on this axis the activity of the cyclin-dependent kinase, the CLIB2 cyclin-dependent kinase that drives the cells into mitosis. And on this axis, say, the mass-to-nucleus ratio, the size of the cell. And when cells are very small, they have only the stable, steady state with very low CLIB activity. That's the G1 phase of the cell cycle. When they get large enough, they undergo a SNCC bifurcation. You lose the node, the stable node, by coalescing with a saddle point, and you generate a large amplitude stable limit cycle. So if the cell is born small, it's in G1, it grows to a critical size, leaves G1, and is captured by a limit cycle oscillation, goes through S phase into M phase, out of mitosis, and the cyclin kinase activity comes down, that's the signal for the cell to divide, and it gets reset across the bifurcation point. So here's cell division. Cell mass goes down by a certain factor. The following daughter cells, they go to a small size, and then they're attracted to the stable, steady state, which is the G1 state of the cell cycle. They have to grow large enough to get past the G1 checkpoint, and then they can do S phase and M phase. When they come out of mitosis, they divide. So we call that a cell cycle trajectory. So I'm going to plot cell cycle trajectories onto bifurcation diagrams like this. This is a schematic. I'll show you the actual calculation.
In the abstract bifurcation diagram, there's a stable limit cycle at all values.
There are stable limit cycles here. The stable limit cycles end at the SNCC bifurcation, and they're replaced by a stable steady state.
Okay.
How can they do that? I mean,
there's a saddle known on an invariant circle that kills the limit cycle.
Oh, I see. So it's okay.
Okay. And there are other bifurcations at very large size, hop bifurcations that create the limit cycle.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't kill. There's still a circle sitting there with this.
But now it's got a stable node on it, and that's the.
But now it's kind of excitable.
It is excitable. Yeah, it's excitable. So when you get close to this point, you can kick it off early. Okay. When you're solving the differential equations, you tend to actually have to pull past it a ways because these limit cycles are infinite period. I'm going to talk about that in a second. Okay, so here's the actual bifurcation diagram calculated from the model that we use to fit the data. Okay, and as advertised, it has a single, stable, steady state at small size. That's the G1 phase of the cell cycle, and a SNCC bifurcation generating these large amplitude oscillations. Okay, here's the purported simulation of the wild type budding yeast cell, and the mass is the bifurcation parameter, and the CLIB2 dependent kinase activity is the state variable. So I can take those two curves and plot them parametrically in time onto the bifurcation diagram, and there's the cell cycle trajectory. So here's the cell dividing when it comes out of mitosis, attracted to the stable steady state, but before it can get there, it grows large enough to surpass the bifurcation. It has to pull past it quite a ways before it gets caught by the limit cycle, S phase, M phase, then exiting mitosis and dividing again. And this is at a mass doubling time of 150 minutes. And the time it takes to go around that loop is 150 minutes. Well, actually, this is a daughter cell. The daughter cells take a little longer. The mother cells take a little shorter. On average, it's 150 minutes cycle time. Okay, if we increase, I'm going to talk about the balance between growth and division. So let's decrease the mass doubling time, increase how rapidly the cells are growing, raise the growth rate, and replot the cell cycle trajectory. It has now moved to larger sizes, and the time to go around that trajectory is shorter, because the bigger cells can get through the cycle faster, and the cell cycle time is balanced with the mass doubling time. And as we decrease the mass doubling time further, 90 minutes is about as fast as they go, the cells get bigger and go around the cycle faster.
What makes the system go out of the limit cycle?
Go out in this direction?
Going back to the...
This is division, right?
Yes.
So at the very small growth rate, at the long mass doubling times, the cells are small when they divide, and division brings them past the bifurcation point, and they're attracted to the stable, steady state. Okay. When they're growing very rapidly, they're living all the time in the limit cycle regime, and yet they're balancing the cycle time with the mass doubling time. And I want to explain how they do that.
Is the fixed point at low mass, is that sitting on the circle? Is that set a separate one?
It's, well, right here at the SNCC, the saddle and the node are on the circle.
Yeah.
When you pull away, of course, there is an invariant circle, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So the small one is sitting on a circle, but...
But it's not a limit cycle.
Yeah,
it's not relevant.
Yeah.
So I don't want to get into the mathy details, okay?
No, I just wanted to know whether there's an extra one.
An extra steady state.
There's only one steady state.
There's a bunch of other steady states. They're all unstable.
Yeah, but they're all kind of connected.
Yeah. I mean, you can go into all the details. It's all consistent. I want to emphasize the physiological consequences here. Okay?
So, can I ask, is it true that when the mass doubling time is reduced, it's more difficult to activate the checkpoints?
But... Oh, that checkpoint. Oh. I don't know, I haven't thought about that.
Because you move to the away from the node.
It shouldn't, no, because when you activate the checkpoints, you change the bifurcation diagram completely, right? And now you insert new stable steady states. I think they'll capture.
Like the little nodes on the left, you become...
Yeah, but I'm not going to talk about it. Okay, you're derailing me. Stop. Okay. So here's the bifurcation diagram, the SNCC bifurcation, squashed up at the top, because what I want to plot here is the period of the limit cycle oscillation as a function of the bifurcation parameter, as I pull away from the SNCC bifurcation. And the characteristic of SNCC bifurcations is that as you approach the bifurcation point, the period goes to infinity. It's sometimes called an infinite period bifurcation. So you can see the period going to infinity as we come close to the SNCC bifurcation. So there's a very large change in the period of the limit cycle oscillation as a function of the size of the cell. Now, what are the cells doing? If you grow cells at a short mass doubling time, so they're growing very fast, remember their cell cycle trajectory is up here in the limit cycle region at large size. Now I'm taking that cell cycle trajectory that I used to plot here, and I'm just bringing it down and plotting it on this curve. Here's the cell cycle trajectory, and look what the cell is doing. The small cells, the limit cycle is long, and as the cell gets bigger and bigger, the limit cycle period goes down, right? So it's not on a stable limit cycle, it's sampling these limit cycles. And the average period that it takes to get around this loop is some average between the short period limit cycles and the long period limit cycles. And it finds a place on the diagram where the average period of the limit cycle oscillation is identical to the mass doubling time, which is 90 minutes. So the straight line across here is the mass doubling time. And the limit cycle finds that place on the bifurcation diagram where its average cycle time is equal to the mass doubling time. If I decrease the mass doubling time, then the cell cycle trajectory moves to smaller sizes or longer periods, so that again, the average period on the limit cycle is equal to the mass doubling time. At slower growth rates still, the cell moves to such small sizes that it comes into the stable steady state region. And it just fits on the stable steady state as long as it needs to grow large enough so that it can balance the cycle time with the mass doubling time. And at longer mass doubling time still, it just spends more and more time on the stable steady state. Dan?
So this seems to make another prediction. When you're close to that bifurcation, you should be very sensitive to noise.
Yes?
That the smaller the mass size here, or the faster the doubling rate, the more sensitive. So the slower the doubling rate,
yes.
The more sensitive.
Yes. Yes, you're exactly right, and we haven't figured that out yet, but we're moving in that direction, and if I have time, I'll get to it. Okay, so that's our explanation of balanced growth and division on the basis of the bifurcation diagram and the properties of a SNCC bifurcation. That fundamentally is the mathematical reason why the cell cycle is able to balance itself to the growth rate. And the period of going through the cell cycle doesn't depend on any of the kinetic parameters, right? This is the point I try to make over and over again. The period of the cell cycle control system doesn't depend upon the rate constant of cyclin synthesis or the phosphorylation of this, that, or the other thing. Normally, that's the way limit cycles work. Of course, the limit cycle period does depend on those things, but the control system averages it out. Because of the mass dependence, the control system can find the place where the average limit cycle period is equal to the mass doubling time. And it has to be able to do that, or this isn't a viable system.
But the mass doubling time is an input into your model.
The mass doubling time is a parameter. It's the only parameter in the system that the timing depends on.
It's a bit like forcing in force
also. Yeah. The phases all depend upon the growth rate, but the period doesn't. Yeah. Okay. Now, this is really cool. We got to do this. The mutant phenotypes are direct consequences of altered bifurcation diagrams. So I was explaining the wild type. What happens when you mutate the system? What happens to the bifurcation diagrams? And what happens to the physiology? Okay? So let's consider mutations of these two genes that encode the proteins that stabilize the G1 phase of the cell cycle. Okay? They both play a role in G1. What happens if I knock them out individually, knock out the one or the other? the lack of either one of the G1 enemies still gives you viable cells. The bifurcation diagrams are different. This one still has a SNP bifurcation, but this one doesn't have a SNP bifurcation. It has a subcritical Hopf bifurcation. But the cells can still balance growth and division. Although these cells are subtly different from wild-type cells in how big they are, because they have to find the right place on the bifurcation diagram where they can balance cell growth and division. But they're still viable cells. On the other hand, if we mutate the gene for CDC20 or for CDC14, those mutations are inviable. You can tell by the name. The CDC name means they're inviable mutants. And when we compute the bifurcation diagrams, we see the oscillations have been killed altogether. We have a stable mitotic state with either a very high level of MPF, that's metaphase arrest, or an intermediate level of cyclin B activity, that's a telophase arrest. And those are the properties of those two mutants. They come directly from the bifurcation diagrams. Now, these are some more subtle mutants, but this is a cool story. These are mutations that give defects in exit from mitosis. So here's the bifurcation diagram for wild-type cells and the cell cycle trajectories at different growth rates, balanced growth and division. Here's a crazy mutant where you knock out CDH1 and you kind of cripple the APC. These cells are still viable. Here's the bifurcation diagram. These cells are viable. They're viable if they're grown at a slow growth rate, a mass doubling time of 150 minutes. Here's the cell cycle trajectory. But what the mutation has done, you can see what the mutation has done, is it's taken the Hopf bifurcation, which in wild-type cells is way out here, it's pulled the Hopf bifurcation down into this region where we can see it. It's a subcritical Hopf bifurcation that generates these large amplitude limit cycles. And now, if we try to grow this mutant at a high growth rate, at a short mass doubling time, 120 minutes, it comes past the SNP bifurcation, goes into S, G2, and M, but is growing so fast that before it can try to get out of mitosis, it gets captured by the stable mitotic steady state, and it arrests in mitosis. So the viability of this mutant depends upon the growth rate. It's viable at slow growth rates, and it arrests in mitosis at high growth rates. And here are three other mutants with the same characteristics, that they're viable at low growth rate and arrested in mitosis at high growth rate.
Other temperatures?
Pardon me?
Do you go to much lower cold temperatures, or what is it that you mean?
I don't know. Kathy, two of these are known, right? And one of them is a prediction.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where they're doing it, right? And like I say, two of these phenotypes are known. It's a curious fact about these mutants. And the third one hasn't been done yet, so we predict that it'll have the same curious phenotype of being viability being growth rate dependent. And it's all because you've moved this Hopf bifurcation into a region where you can see it now.
It's a subcritical
Hopf bifurcation.
But how do you implement the growth rate in the model?
There's a variable in the model called mass, and it controls how much CLIN3 is in the nucleus. So it controls the CLIN3 activity, and that's the thing that triggers everything. And the mass grows exponentially. And at division, the daughter gets a fraction of the mass, and the mother gets 1 minus F fraction of the mass.
And the connection between glucose and CLIN3 is established?
Well, I mean, you can change growth rates by changing the sugar or the source or other nutrient manipulations. That's a bit tricky because there are going to be other modifications of the system when you go on a different glucose source.
Glucose, they grow fast. Manganese and galactose, they grow slower.
It's just that connection to CLIN3. Is it a reasonable way for you to simulate it?
Well, we think it is on the basis of Fred Cross's experiments where he manipulates the nuclear localization signals and can push more or less CLIN3 into the nucleus, and the model is consistent with that.
Can someone just show that in high glucose you have high CLIN3?
Well, the cells are bigger. In glucose, they grow faster and they're bigger. So they're going to have more CLIN3.
CLIN3 has also translational control, and this glucose is activating the translationary to the TOR pathway, activates translation. So in a way, high glucose concentration accelerates CLIN3 production to that because of translationary.
You're specific. That's all I'm...
Yeah, okay. This is the first try at getting these things, and it gets the basic ideas right.
Absolutely.
There are lots of more molecular details that aren't in the model yet that should be. And in fact, that's the subject of a grant proposal we haven't written yet. Okay, but I want to push on. Two-parameter bifurcation diagrams connect genetics to physiology. So remember what a two-parameter bifurcation diagram is. The first parameter is mass, what I've always been using for my bifurcation diagram. So it tells me how big the cells are, and when they divide, they get reset in the mass axis. Now I want to use the second dimension to represent a second parameter to represent the level of gene expression of a particular gene. And in general, for the systems that we're considering, these two-parameter bifurcation diagrams have this region of bistability. So we have the G1 stable steady state seen here at low sizes. And then they have hop bifurcations and saddle loop bifurcations and SNP bifurcations. They fit together in this fashion. And a region of oscillations. The green region is a region of oscillations. Now, how you read a two-parameter bifurcation diagram is, at the wild-type level of expression, you do a cut across here, and you get a one-parameter bifurcation diagram, which is the one we've been seeing all along. As you move from small size, you see first the saddle node bifurcation, then a saddle loop bifurcation, then a subcritical hop bifurcation, and then a SNP bifurcation. That's the standard wild-type picture. But we know, kind of from general principles, that if we change the level of expression of any of these genes, we'll start to survey the two-parameter bifurcation diagram. So if we knock down the activity of this gene, say with a temperature-sensitive mutant, we might see a completely different bifurcation picture, which will give different physiology, and this cell may not be viable because it may not be able to get out of mitosis. It's not clear. It's got a stable mitotic state. And if we delete the gene altogether, we'll get a different bifurcation diagram still. So the bifurcation, and we know that the bifurcation diagram controls the behavior of the control system, dictates the behavior of the control system, and therefore the physiology of the cells. So this two-parameter bifurcation diagram, I maintain, is a direct connection between the genetics and the physiology of the system. And all the mathematics and all the modeling is folded into the bifurcation diagram, and we can read directly from genetics to physiology, which is kind of the holy grail of computational molecular biology, is it not?
Well, but gene expression isn't a parameter, right? Or are you thinking of the parameter in front of
you? I'm thinking of the parameter in the rate equation, right? So if I knock out the gene, I set that parameter to zero. That's this place, right? And here's wild-type expression level. And I can knock it out, or I can overexpress it, and I sweep through the two-parameter bifurcation diagram, and it should predict the physiology of all these mutants. Okay, so here, yes.
There was an experiment by Wallen, I think. He looked at the expression levels of a specific protein in yeast, and showed that in wild-type population, there was this exponential distribution of the given protein. I think that was the guy that happened to that for example. But you expect that there are large fluctuations in the concentrations in even wild type population. Mm-hmm. That means that you don't...
You mean from cell to cell? From cell to cell?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to put that question off because the next part of my talk is about stochastic modeling, okay, which I'm going to get to. So this is all deterministic modeling. I'm trying...
Even in deterministic modeling, the wild type is not aligned, but there is a width.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Different behaviors according to that.
Yeah, okay, but as a matter of fact, wild type cells aren't that different. It's a very robust system. And the ODEs can give you a very good description of a lot of biology, but I'm going to come to it, I promise you. There's some stuff we can't get right with a deterministic model, and we need a stochastic model, okay? You're pointing in that direction, but I'm almost done with the deterministic models. Just want to show you these bifurcation diagrams. This is for the expression of the gene encoding the cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor. And that's the one, if we knock it out, the cells are still viable, okay? So here's the wild type level. That's the one parameter bifurcation diagram, and this little black bar was the cell cycle trajectory, which I've just squashed down onto the two parameter bifurcation diagram. So the cells are born here at a stable G1 state. They ought to get past the SNP bifurcation, and then they go through the oscillation, and then they divide and come back, okay? So they're perfectly viable. That's the wild type situation. But now I can knock down SYK1 to any level I want. I still have a nice SNP bifurcation, and these cells ought to be viable. And in fact, they are. You can knock it all the way down to zero, and these cells are viable. And if you could control and sweep through here, this diagram would predict to you exactly how big the cells are going to be. So the SYK1 deletion cells are down here. They're finding their place on the in the periodic solutions where they can balance growth with division. On the other hand, and the same thing is true for CDH1. For CDH1, you can just look at the bifurcation diagram and see they're going to be viable at all levels of expression. But for CDC20 and CDC14, if we knock them down, we eventually will get to a region where we no longer have oscillations. We have only stable steady states. And those cells are going to be inviable at low levels of expression. And the two-parameter bifurcation diagram predicts exactly at what level of expression those cells change from being viable cell cycles to being inviable cell cycles. And they also predict the sequence of bifurcations that they have to go through on the way to becoming inviable. Those experiments have never been done. And I don't know if the genetic control in yeast is good enough to sweep down through this bifurcation diagram and check these predictions. But nonetheless, at least from a theoretical point of view, these are beautiful displays of the kinetics between genetics and physiology for a bunch of different mutants. Okay?
Is it obvious without doing the analysis of the right scale to look at these parameters on the logarithmic one? I mean, is it kind of, would an experimentalist automatically have assumed that before?
I don't know. If you don't use a log scale, you can't see anything.
I did a lot of work on bifurcation back in the late 70s. And you could then, you know, they were tiny little things, so I was quite worried when you said you were going to use them here. But of course, if you're doing on a logarithmic scale, then
they can big, don't they? Okay. Let me talk about stochastic models for a while. See how far we get. So. We definitely have a project now where we're trying to convert the deterministic model into a stochastic version. Okay? So I've already proven, I hope I've proven to you, that the deterministic model gives you a lot of information and a lot of insight into how that basic control system works in budding yeast. Okay, that it's consistent with all these mutational phenotypes. And the theory of bifurcation diagrams shows you exactly why they have the phenotypes that they have. I think this is pretty remarkable. But there are some things that the ordinary differential equations can't capture, and we need to go to stochastic models. But we should ask specifically, why would we want to do this? Because this is going to be a lot more work. So the why for me is we're getting more and more single-cell data. So how the control system works in individual cells. And there's going to be definite variability from cell to cell in the behavior of this control system. We'd like to be able to capture that and model that. Also, there are some things that I would call non-deterministic effects. So Danny already alluded to that, that when you're close to a bifurcation point, stochastic fluctuations in the system can either kick you off a little sooner or hold you a little later. When you pull past those SNP bifurcations in the deterministic system, there's a long lag before you can finally catch on to the limit cycle. But you put a little noise in that, and that lag will disappear. So there are these non-deterministic effects that could be significant in single cells, and surely are. And finally, there are some mutant phenotypes which are very curious, where the cells are only half dead. It means when you put that mutation in, they can form little colonies, but not very good colonies. That means they can divide for a while, and then they kind of poop out. Of course, in our deterministic model, cells are either viable or inviable. But for those particular mutants, what we find is they're close to a bifurcation point. Their viability depends upon precisely how you choose the parameters. Okay? And the ones that go on one side of the bifurcation point can go round and round and they're viable. The cells that just skim and go to the other side of the bifurcation point go to a stable steady state and they're inviable. We have to choose which one we want. But of course, if it's a noisy system like that, cells will have a certain probability of repeating the cycle or getting shoved off to the stable steady state and never dividing again. Okay, so I think we need a stochastic model to be able to simulate those sorts of mutants. Second question is, where might the stochasticity in the model in the system be? And there are at least three sources of stochasticity. One is the molecular noise in the control system because of finite numbers of molecules. Well, just exactly how many molecules are there? There's a beautiful study of this in the literature where many of these genes, the protein products of many of the genes in budding yeast cells have been measured and estimated, the average amount per cell in an asynchronous culture. And for the cyclins, the average amount of cyclins, CLID2, CLID5, CLIN2, is on the order of 1,000, 2,000 molecules per cell.
Protein
molecules per cell, okay? But of course, since the cyclins oscillate, at the high, they got to be bigger than that, and at the low, there are 10 or 20 times smaller than that, okay? So at the low phases of the cycle, there are maybe 50 or 100 molecules per cell, and noise could very well be important. There are no messenger RNAs in our model. We assume that the messages just get immediately translated. We could skip them. But actually, messenger RNA levels in yeast cells are very small, like the average less than one molecule per cell in the asynchronous population. So we believe we have to put the messenger RNAs into the model and figure out how much they contribute to the noise. It depends not only on the fact that there are very few messenger RNA molecules per cell, but how fast they're turned over and how fast they're expressed and things like that. But that has to be in the model. Okay? Unequal division. So we always assume that the division process is deterministic. Okay? That the daughter cell gets a fraction F and the mother cell gets a fraction 1 minus F. But of course, there's noise in the division process, and the size at birth has a huge effect on the length of the subsequent cycle. So the inequality in the division process is going to play an important role in determining the stochastic fluctuations of the cell cycle. And finally, when a cell divides into a mother and a daughter, the two different pots of two different volumes, all the molecules have to be distributed between those two different pots. And that's some kind of a binomial distribution of molecules. If you have 1,000 molecules to distribute to two different pots, you're going to get different initial conditions for all of your variables. Now, I don't think that's very important, to tell you the truth, but it's something that we have to take into account when we do the simulation. No fights yet. Now, how do we want to do it? There are a couple of ways you could...
This is just a question.
Yeah.
Is another source of noise environmental or extrinsic? Is that something that the biologists want modeled? No?
I don't think so. I hope not.
You just talked about glucose, and that's something that...
These cells are grown... If you're just doing bulk measurements, I guess they're grown in flasks or grown on... For the single-cell measurements on a microscope slide. I don't know. It's going to depend upon the situation, whether that's going to be an important source of variability. Right now, we're ignoring it. Okay? Now, how do we want to try to convert a deterministic model in terms of nonlinear ordinary differential equations into a stochastic model? There are a couple different ways I could imagine doing this. One is the Langevin approach, in which you take the nonlinear differential equation and you add a white noise term on the end of each differential equation. And you can even kind of predict how big that white noise term has to be on the basis of the rates of the reactions. The Langevin approach requires that the numbers of molecules in the volume be in the intermediate regime. Not so many molecules that you don't have to worry about the noise altogether, but not so few molecules that you that the Langevin approach can bump things below zero. So it only works in a narrow band of interest. And I just don't think I can believe that yeast cells live in that narrow band of interest. So that approach we're not going to pursue. Second approach is what I call poor man's Gillespie. You take the nonlinear ordinary differential equations, maybe convert from chemical concentrations into numbers of molecules per cell, but you still have the same nonlinear differential equations with all these Michaelis-Menten reactions in them and things like that. And you, instead of interpreting the right-hand side as the rate, as the instantaneous rate of the chemical reaction, interpret the terms on the right-hand side as the propensity of the reaction. And then do a Gillespie calculation to update the number of molecules given these nonlinear propensities. That's what I call poor man's Gillespie. There's no reason to believe, that I can see, that that's going to give you reliable results. It would be easy to do and to implement, it would be fast, it would give you noisy stochastic stuff, but could you believe any of it?
I don't quite understand how this differs from the normal Gillespie.
I didn't make this clear, but in the model as we wrote it down, I call it a phenomenological model because we're not considering elementary chemical reactions. We have very complicated rate laws. Okay, now you understand. Okay? If you want to do a full Gillespie, the exact stochastic simulation, you have to unpack all those phenomenological equations down to elementary chemical reactions. Okay? Then you could do an honest-to-goodness exact stochastic simulation.
But it's exact in the sense that it mirrors the stochastic model.
John, I think you misrepresented the condition for the Langevin equation.
Yeah?
The condition is that within the Weier equation, there's a time scale within which the rates, the various rates are constant, and not too varying, such that within that time scale there's a very large number of events. And because the noise term is going to be given by applying the central limit theorem, mm-hmm. and therefore you need a large number of events to occur in a time span in which the various parameters are not changing much. And that's a much weaker condition
than what I said.
Than you expressed, and so it seems it's much more reasonable that the Langevin equation gives good approximations for lower numbers than you're talking about.
Okay, well,
that every single kind of event has to occur very frequently on that time scale.
No, because you're summing over, say, suppose you've got births and deaths. Then basically you're dividing your time scale up into very small things in which at most one event occurs, and then you're summing the plus one or minus one in each of those little time gaps, and that sum is telling you the total change. So it's a sum over births and deaths.
Yeah, I can just make a counterexample to this, okay?
Well,
suppose I have a very small species system, Schlobel reactions, the sort of famous example, my stable, whatever, okay? And then I add just some other events that are totally unrelated.
Oh, yeah, right? Let's not talk about births and deaths of one particular species.
Right, there has to be many events of every species.
Yeah, with every species, that's right.
Every reaction.
Yeah, but not. They don't have to be the same event. They can be birth, within one species. They can be births and deaths.
I think John gave an operational definition of when it's good and when it isn't. If it's too low, there's no zero.
It defines the operational definition.
Well, okay, let's fight about this elsewhere, okay? Then we call a halt. If you can make Langevin work, that would be nice. That would be a lot easier than what I'm proposing. Well, let's see what I'm proposing. Am I really proposing to do a full Gillespie on this? That's kind of dumb. We have to unpack all of these phenomenological rate equations to elementary reactions. That means we're going to double or triple the number of molecular species in the model, because we have all these complexes. And you're going to introduce a whole bunch of new rate constants. And furthermore, the rate constants that you introduce are inestimable from the data that we have, because they're all fast reactions that we can't see. And those rate constants are going to control the fluctuations of all of those complexes. And what are we going to use for those rate constants?
Something big.
Yeah, we use something big, but then we don't know how to interpret the fluctuations that we see, because it's going to depend upon how big, it seems to me, on how big those rate constants are. Okay, and also we don't want to have to simulate every single molecular event, which is what Gillespie does, when most of the molecular events are these rapid association and dissociation of the complexes that we can't follow anyhow. We spend all of our time computing stuff that we can't measure, and we have no idea of the time scales.
But when you have a low number of molecules, the rapid equilibrium assumption, doesn't longer apply, so...
Are you applying your arguments to both the Gillespie versions of it? Or are you just talking...
No, I'm just talking about exact Gillespie. Then maybe we want to think twice about trying to do exact Gillespie. But now I want to tell you what we're trying to do, and then you can come at me. Okay, so this work is being done in collaboration with Bill Bowman and Mark Paul at Virginia Tech, and my two postdocs, Sandeep Kaur and Debashish Barak. Andrea Chiliberto and Mohsen Saborigomi have also been involved in this project in the last couple of years. So here's what we're doing. I'll take a simple example. This is just one piece of the reaction mechanism. It's that part of the G1 control where active CDH1 degrades cyclin B and keeps the cyclin B level very low. But if we can make some cyclin B dependent kinase, it can phosphorylate CDH1 and inactivate it. So this is the molecular antagonism of those two components of the control system. And CDC14 is the phosphatase that removes that phosphate group and activates CDH1. Okay? Now, I just rewrite the mechanism with X's and Y's. Okay? And convert the mechanism into phenomenological nonlinear differential equations. Synthesis of X, degradation of X by a linear pathway, and then degradation of X by the catalytic reaction with Y. And use Michaelis-Menten kinetics here. And then Y is a Goldbeater-Koechlin switch. It's being phosphorylated by X and dephosphorylated by A. This is typically the way we model these things. It's very nice because we can draw a phase plane for this little system, and we can see that under the right conditions, we can get three stable steady states. And as the cell grows, as S increases, S for size, as the cell grows, the null climb moves in this direction, we lose the low steady state, that's the G1 steady state, and we have only the high steady state, that's the SG2M steady state. So this is the G1S transition in toy form. In fact, this is how we built the whole thing to begin with. We worked with these little toys, and we got the right parameter values for all these little toys, and then we put the toys together, and we had good guesses for the parameter values as we built the model up into more and more complicated form. Okay, and here's the bifurcation diagram for this toy model as a function of cell size. You see the saddle node bifurcation. Okay, now, before we can do exact Gillespie, we need to unpack these Michaelis-Menten equations, right? So here's what I call unpacking. There's the schematic wiring diagram, And here's the full wiring diagram where we introduce all the enzyme substrate complexes. So this means X and Y combine to form a complex. That's a reversible reaction. That's what the dots mean. That's a reversible reaction. And this is where Y is an enzyme that's trying to destroy X. And when it does so, X is destroyed and Y is recreated. Meanwhile, X binds to Y, and now X is the enzyme trying to phosphorylate Y. And when it does so, we get YP and we get X back again. So we've unpacked the enzyme-catalyzed reactions. And we convert those into differential equations. What do we do? We dial up CRNT and we ask whether this mechanism can have multiple steady states, and it says no.
What's CRNT?
CRNT? Chemical reactor network theory.
Oh.
It's a miracle. CRNT is a miracle program. You just type in your reactions and it comes back and it tells you either no multiple steady states or it delivers you a set of parameter values that'll give you multiple steady states. And sometimes it may come back and shrug and say, I don't know, but that hasn't happened to us very often. So it's a miracle. Jeremy knows how it works.
I think the only person who knows how it works is Martin Feinberg.
I think God's the only one who knows how it works, but it says there's no multiple steady states. No matter what parameter values you use, you can't get multiple steady states. And by golly, when you compute the bifurcation diagram, there are no longer multiple steady states. This is a disaster. The whole model is built on the saddle node bifurcations in this part of the control system. And when we unpack it, we lose the very heart of the system.
You're still at the deterministic.
I'm still doing deterministic differential equations. Okay? And so now we're in big trouble. We scratched our head, and how are we going to regain bistability in this control system? Maybe we've neglected some things, right? Well,
so I'm trying to confuse. So there's something. There's also a different set of equations. So is there no connection between the second set of equations and the first?
Well, there sure is, right? The first set of equations came from this mechanism, written like this, using Michaelis-Menten approximation for the rate. Now we try to unpack that and follow the intermediates, and it doesn't work anymore. And the reason it doesn't work is because when you write a Michaelis-Menten rate law, you're implicitly assuming that the concentration of the substrate is much greater than the concentration of the enzyme, so you can neglect the enzyme-substrate complexes. In this case, that's impossible because X and Y swap roles as substrate and enzyme. So you can't neglect the complexes, and when you put the complexes in, you lose the bistability.
That's a very good pedagogical example.
Yeah, it's a very nice example. That's a great example of why sometimes looking at a more detailed, more complicated model might be a good thing.
Or a bad thing. Anybody else want to complain? This is a good story, though. Let's keep going. Now we got to get bistability back in. It has to be there, right? There's some other reactions that must come into play. Well, I don't know what they are for sure, but we can propose something. So this is what Andrea figured out. Bela and I and Mosin were going down a different route, but this is a very elegant way to fix it. And it's elegant because it shouldn't work. Intuitively, it's not intuitive. Remember, Y is trying to degrade X. And we get the bistability because X phosphorylates Y and turns Y off, right? So now X can win. But when we unpack it, we don't have bistability. And now we can rescue bistability by doing the opposite thing that you would ever expect. We let YP bind to X and degrade X. That seems to be giving extra abilities to Y to get rid of X. It seems to make X even weaker. And yet, when you pass that model to CRNT, it says yes. And you get back the same bifurcation diagram that you had before. Now it's bistable again. It's a miracle.
It's exactly the same.
Well, no, it's not exactly the same. The saddle nose are in different, slightly different locations, but it's not far off.
What about the enzymes themselves? I'm not a little bit, because X and Y and A and X5, those are either, they're not in the, they are at what I would call at the metabolic level, right? But what about the enzymes?
No. These are all proteins. They're not in
Okay, but the enzymes which turn over the protein, right?
These are all,
X and Y
are the enzymes, and they are the substrates. It's a protein interaction network.
The problem is they have to go through this X, Y, and Y, X then.
So they have to go through the complexes, and we've been ignoring the complexes for 15 years. And I just proved to you, you can't ignore the complexes.
Yeah, you've got to somehow separate those two steps. You've got to break that middle bit so they don't have to see each other in some way.
I don't know, but this works. I'm glad. Now we've got bi-stability back again. Now we're back in business.
So what you're saying is whenever you represent, an enzyme-catalyzed reaction by, the reaction between the substrate and the enzyme substrate and then the product plus the free enzyme.
Yeah.
And you plug that back into your equations, then you don't, and whatever rate constants you're using, then you do not represent.
You don't get Michaelis-Menten kinetics.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show you what you get. Give me a chance. No, there's no reason why you should. Okay, it's going to all cut clear. Trust me.
But it's because your original model for Michaelis-Menten, the conditions weren't always satisfied.
They were never satisfied. We were lucky to get away with it for so long.
But they can never be satisfied.
Yeah.
Yeah. The requirements are in Michaelis-Menten that you either have a steady state or you have a rapid equilibrium.
No. The real assumption is that the enzyme-substrate complex is a slow variable.
Wait. I'm going to explain everything, okay? There are two... Wait! Class, come to order! There are two ways to get the Michaelis-Menten approximation. The classic way is the assumption that the total substrate is much larger than total enzyme, which means that you can neglect the enzyme-substrate complex relative to the substrate.
No, I don't think that's true.
That is true. The other way to do it, which I'm going to show you, is you can assume that there's rapid equilibrium.
No, but those are the same thing.
They're not the same thing.
They ultimately mathematically give the same conclusion, which is that the enzyme-substrate complex is a slow variable, that its rate of change is basically constant.
That is true, but there's a difference between the enzyme-substrate complex being given by a quasi-steady-state approximation and that it's negligible with respect to the substrate. I'm going to show you. We'll go over this quickly. Now we have an elementary reaction mechanism, and we can do honest-to-goodness Gillespie simulations of that little piece of the network, okay? Because now we have
the expanded bit,
okay? And you can see it, as we increase size, we're at the lower steady state, we go past the saddle node bifurcation, and then we go to the upper steady state. So that's the solution of the deterministic equation, and here are the solutions of the stochastic equation. Here's CDH1 fluctuating like mad when you're in the off state with low cyclin B, and then finally CDH1 gets shut off. And cyclin B can start accumulating. Okay, so now
not bistable. That's agreeing with. Are you saying that's bistable?
I'm saying the nonlinear ODEs predict a bistable system, and we go past the saddle node bifurcation, and then this is the stochastic simulation of that bistable system. Okay. Now I want to get into this business of how you approximate these enzyme substrate reactions when enzyme and substrate are at roughly the same concentration. The nonlinear ODEs are going to look like this, okay? For X, there's synthesis and degradation, and then there's the formation of these complexes, and the complexes get converted into products, okay? I'm just writing the differential equations for the fully unpacked mechanism. I have an equation for x, I have an equation for y, I have an equation for all the complexes. And all the complexes look the same. There's association and dissociation and turnover of the complexes. Okay? And the normal approach here, the quasi-steady state approximation, is that the complexes change quickly in time and come to a quasi-steady state. And then, if you can solve these quasi-steady state equations, you plug them back up here, and you get the you get an approximation to the slow variables. Okay, and this gives you the Michaelis-Menten equations when substrate concentration is high compared to total enzyme. If the concentrations are in the same ballpark, then you have to do it a little differently. It still works, but you have to do it a little differently. You have to define total variables. So you're looking at the total amount of x, which is the free x plus the x in all the complexes. And these are no longer negligible. So total x and free x are not the same thing. Okay? And then rewrite, that's called the total quasi-steady state approximation. And that's the proper way to formulate the differential equations. Now the differential equations look like this. In terms of the total variables, x and y, we get for x total, slow synthesis, slow degradation, slow turnover of the complex that's degrading x, and slow turnover of the complex that's degrading X using YP as the enzyme. So these are all slow reactions. And the same for Y. They're slow reactions. They're the turnover of the complexes. Meanwhile, the complexes still obey the same differential equations. They're fast, so we could do the singular perturbation, set the rates equal to zero, and solve the, so I properly separated the slow variables from the fast variables. Now you agree with me, right? We're saying the same thing. And now I solve the fast equations for the concentrations of the complex. But it's nasty now, right? Up to here it looked fine. The concentrations of the complexes depend upon the concentrations of the free variables, but those aren't the variables in the differential equation. They're the total variables. So I have to do this substitution and then multiply all this out. And I get a really ugly set of coupled nonlinear algebraic equations. They're quadratic at worst, but they're four nasty quadratic equations in four unknowns. But if I solve those equations, they're a consistent set of equations for any given values of x hat and y hat, I can solve those equations and get the quasi-steady state concentrations of all the complexes, which I can then plug into the slow equations and solve just the slow differential equations. Of course, this is just a differential algebraic equation system, right? And there's good code to solve these equations.
Yes!
Thanks to Linda.
Well, another approach might be to have a rapid equilibrium assumption in your
mechanistic
approach.
This is a rapid equilibrium. I'm assuming K2F and K2R are large so that I get the rapid equilibrium making these complexes. These are the fast reactions, and these are all slow reactions. So that's the assumption I'm making. And the beauty of this is I don't have to know what those rate constants are. I'm assuming that they're big, but I don't have to know what they are, and they're not measurable. Well, they come into the definitions. These are just classic Michaelis constants, and those I can estimate from the data. Okay? So, now you have a way of doing this deterministically by solving the differential algebraic equations. And let me just summarize what we've been doing. Bale and I originally just kind of cavalierly wrote Michaelis-Menten kinetics for all of these reactions. And that's not right in any sense. It doesn't even give us the right steady states. We predicted multiple steady states, and when you unpack them, there's only a single steady state. So So of course it can't get anything else right if it doesn't even get the steady states right. If you do classical quasi-steady state approximation, you'll get the steady states right, because you're always solving the same steady state equation, but you substitute it back into the, and do the differential algebraic equation, you don't get the transients right, so you're not going to get a stochastic simulation isn't going to mean anything, because you're not getting the transients right. But the total quasi-steady state approximation gets the steady states right, gets the transients right when you solve the ordinary differential equation, and now I want to show you that it also gets the stochastics right. That, no, maybe I'm not going to show you that. What's the next? Oh, no, I'm not going to show you that. We're still doing it. But Debasis is doing, and Sandeep are doing calculations on these kinds of mechanisms to compare the exact Gillespie simulation with poor man's Gillespie using the TQSSA equations. So now what I mean by poor man's Gillespie is these are all elementary reactions, and they're slow reactions. They're propensities for unit changes in numbers of x and number of y. So I'm going to do Gillespie updates on these equations, and every time I update, I resolve the fast equations to tell me what to update the complexes. So I don't follow the rapid binding association and dissociation of the complexes. I get those from the algebraic equation. I only follow the stochastics of the slower variables that are changing on the time scale of interest. And remarkably, not only do we get the means right, but we get the variances right of all the components from this speeded up Gillespie. So this is the approach that we want to take. And I'm just going to tease you, some of you.
Sorry, John, that's a theorem? Or it's
not I don't know that it's a theorem. A lot of people are thinking, it's true of this system as we've studied it so far. And I wanted to get down to the nuts and bolts here, or else I couldn't trust anything. I wanted to fully unpack this thing, understand it completely, be able to do exact Gillespie simulations, and then be able to compare my different approximations to find a way to get stochastic simulations that were fast and easy and accurate when compared to exact Gillespie. And I think this is the way to do it.
What would happen now, if you go back to your beautiful deterministic discussion?
Yes?
What would happen there if you now rework all your equations back out in this form? And now we don't use your old equations, we use these new ones.
Mm-hmm.
You have a bit of a problem, don't you?
Why?
Well, I don't know, it looks like you're going to get lots of bifurcations disappearing.
We're going to have to do it very carefully. And when the bifurcations disappear, we're going to have to think about what are the other reactions that need to be there to bring them back. The bifurcations are there, for sure. I often tell people, look at the bifurcation diagrams. I often tell people, I do not stand behind my equations or my parameter values. They could easily be wrong. But the bifurcation diagrams can't possibly be wrong. So when we write this phenomenological equations with phenomenological rate constants, we're sweeping a lot of stuff under the rug. But we can get to those bifurcation diagrams. And because the bifurcation diagrams are so consistent with everything we know about the physiology of the system, they have to be right.
Yeah, but you've done something very strange here, because you've got this beautiful discussion in terms of deterministic systems where you can do lots of lovely analysis and really understand whether your finding makes sense or not. And then suddenly you say, right, I'm going to jump from this totally deterministic thing with infinite numbers of molecules to, I'm not going to look at your algebra equations because that's some intermediate rate, even though it's far more reasonable than what I've been doing so far in terms of numbers of molecules. I'm going to go right to the other end and do exactly less. So that's a little bit strange, where there's not much chance of being able to do analysis and so on. You know, I mean, you're going to end up doing lots of simulations.
For sure. Okay, so this is the teaser. I'm not going to do this because we don't have any time left, but we've been working on a hybrid model of cell cycle events that's related particularly to the kind of flow cytometry data that Joe was talking about yesterday. I think that's a really great way to get at the stochasticity of molecular events in the cell cycle. And these approaches that I've been telling you about with nonlinear ODEs and Gillespie simulations and things like that, I don't think are appropriate at this stage for that kind of data. And we have an entirely different way of modeling the control system that's key to flow cytometry data, but I don't have time to talk about it. Anybody who's interested, I'd be glad to go over these slides with you, but we're gonna bail. Okay. So I'll just put up my... what happened here? Yeah, so those are all the nice people that helped me do this. And as usual, I think we adjourn now. We've had plenty of discussion and time for lunch. We'll meet again, coffee at 3:30, and knockdown drag out at 4 on simple and complex models.